The following is a conversation with Andrew Ng, one of the most impactful educators, researchers, innovators, and leaders in artificial intelligence and technology space in general. He co-founded Coursera and Google Brain, launched Deep Learning AI, Landing AI, and the AI Fund, and was the chief scientist at Baidu. As a Stanford professor and with Coursera and Deep Learning AI, he has helped educate and inspire millions of students, including me. This is the Artificial Intelligence Podcast. If you enjoy it, subscribe on YouTube, give it 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, support it on Patreon, or simply connect with me on Twitter at Lex Friedman, spelled F-R-I-D-M-A-N. As usual, I'll do 1 or 2 minutes of ads now and never any ads in the middle that can break the flow of the conversation. I hope that works for you and doesn't hurt the listening experience. This show is presented by Cash App, the number one finance app in the App Store. When you get it, use code LEXPODCAST. Cash App lets you send money to friends, buy Bitcoin, and invest in the stock market with as little as $1. Brokerage services are provided by Cash App Investing, a subsidiary of Square, a member SIPC. Since Cash App allows you to buy Bitcoin, let me mention that cryptocurrency in the context of the history of money is fascinating. I recommend Ascent of Money as a great book on this history. Debits and credits on ledgers started over 30,000 years ago. The US dollar was created over 200 years ago. And Bitcoin, the first decentralized cryptocurrency, released just over 10 years ago. So given that history, cryptocurrency is still very much in its early days of development, but is still aiming to, and just might, redefine the nature of money. So again, if you get Cash App from the App Store or Google Play and use the code LEXPODCAST, you'll get $10, and Cash App will also donate $10 to FIRST, one of my favorite organizations that is helping to advance robotics and STEM education for young people around the world. And now, here's my conversation with Andrew Ng. The courses you taught on machine learning at Stanford and later on Coursera that you co-founded have educated and inspired millions of people. So let me ask you, what people or ideas inspired you to get into computer science and machine learning when you were young? When did you first fall in love with the field? Is another way to put it.
Growing up in Hong Kong and Singapore, I started learning to code when I was 5 or 6 years old. At that time, I was learning the basic programming language, and they would take these books and, you know, they'll tell you, type this program into your computer. So type that program to my computer. And as a result of all that typing, I would get to play these very simple shoot 'em up games that you know, I had implemented on my little computer. So I thought it was fascinating as a young kid that I could write this code that was really just copying code from a book into my computer to then play these cool little video games. Another moment for me was when I was a teenager and my father, who's a doctor, was reading about X-bit systems and about neural networks. So he got me to read some of these books, and I thought it was really cool. You could write a computer that started to exhibit intelligence. Then I remember doing an internship while I was in high school. This was in Singapore, where I remember doing a lot of photocopying and I was office assistant. And the highlight of my job was when I got to use the shredder. So the teenager me remember thinking, boy, this is a lot of photocopying. If only we could write software, build a robot, something to automate this, maybe I could do something else. So I think a lot of my work since then has centered on the theme of automation. Even the way I think about machine learning today, we're very good at writing learning algorithms that can automate things that people can do, or even launching the first MOOCs, Massive Open Online Courses, that later led to Coursera. I was trying to automate what could be automatable in how I was teaching on campus.
Process of education tried to automate parts of that to make it more sort of to have more impact from a single teacher, single educator.
Yeah, I felt, you know, teaching at Stanford, I was teaching machine learning to about 400 students a year at the time. And I found myself filming the exact same video every year, like telling the same jokes in the same room. And I thought, why am I doing this? Why don't we just take last year's video? And then I can spend my time building a deeper relationship with students. So that process of thinking through how to do that, that led to the first MOOCs that we launched.
And then you have more time to write new jokes. Are there favorite memories from your early days at Stanford teaching thousands of people in person and then millions of people online?
You know, teaching online, what not many people know was that a lot of those videos were shot between the hours of 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. A lot of times, we're launching the first MOOCs at Stanford, we'd already announced the course, about 100,000 people had signed up. We just started to write the code and we had not yet actually filmed the videos. So, you know, a lot of pressure, 100,000 people waiting for us to produce the content. So many Fridays, Saturdays, I would go out, have dinner with my friends, and then I would think, okay, do you want to go home now or do you want to go to the office to film videos? And the thought of being able to help 100,000 people potentially learn machine learning, fortunately, that made me think, okay, I'm going to go to my office, go to my tiny little recording studio. I would adjust my Logitech webcam, adjust my Wacom tablet, make sure my lapel mic was on. And then I would start recording often until 2 a.m. or 3 a.m. I think I'm fortunate that it doesn't show that it was recorded that late at night, but it was really inspiring, the thought that we could create content to help so many people learn about machine learning.
How did that feel? The fact that you're probably somewhat alone, maybe a couple of friends recording with a Logitech webcam and kind of going home alone at 1 or 2 a.m. at night, and knowing that that's going to reach sort of thousands of people, eventually millions of people, is what's that feeling like? I mean, is there a feeling of just satisfaction of pushing through?
I think it's humbling, and I wasn't thinking about what I was feeling. I think one thing that I'm proud to say we got right from the early days was I told my whole team back then that the number one priority is to do what's best for learners, do what's best for students. And so when I went to the recording studio, the only thing on my mind was, what can I say? How can I design my slides? What do I need to draw right to make these concepts as clear as possible for learners? I think, you know, I've seen sometimes instructors, it's tempting to, hey, let's talk about my work. Maybe if I teach you about my research, someone will cite my papers a couple more times. And I think one of the things we got right launching the first few MOOCs and later building Coursera was putting in place that bedrock principle of let's just do what's best for learners and forget about everything else. And I think that as a guiding principle turned out to be really important to the rise of the MOOC movement.
And the kind of learner you imagined in your mind is as broad as possible, as global as possible. So really try to reach as many people interested in machine learning and AI as possible.
I really want to help anyone that had an interest in machine learning to break into the field. And I think sometimes, I've actually had people ask me, hey, why are you spending so much time explaining gradient descent? And my answer was, if I look at what I think the learner needs and would benefit from, I felt that having that a good understanding of the foundations, kind of back to the basics, would put them in a better stead to then build on a long-term career. So we try to consistently make decisions on that principle.
So one of the things you actually revealed to the narrow AI community at the time and to the world is that the amount of people who are actually interested in AI is much larger than we imagined. By you teaching the class and how popular it became, it showed that, wow, this isn't just a small community of sort of people who go to NeurIPS and it's much bigger. It's developers, it's people from all over the world. I'm Russian, so everybody in Russia is really interested. There's a huge number of programmers who are interested in machine learning, India, China, South America, everywhere. There's just millions of people who are interested in machine learning. So how big do you get a sense that this, the number of people is that are interested from your perspective?
I think the number's grown over time. I think it's one of those things that maybe it feels like it came out of nowhere, but it's an insider building it. It took years. It's one of those overnight successes that took years to get there. My first foray into this type of online education was when we were filming my Stanford class and sticking the videos on YouTube and some other things. We had uploaded the homeworks and so on, but it's, you know, basically the 1 hour, 15 minute video that we put on YouTube. And then we had four or five other versions of websites that I had built, most of which you would never have heard of because they reached small audiences, but that allowed me to iterate, allowed my team and me to iterate, to learn what are the ideas that work and what doesn't. For example, one of the features I was really excited about and really proud of was build this website where multiple people could be logged into the website at the same time. So today, if you go to a website, you know, if you're logged in and then